rolled up his sleeve, and showed upon his forearm a peculiar sign which appeared to have been branded there. It was a circle with a triangle within it. "Do you know what that means?"
"I neither know nor care."
"Well, you will know, I'll promise you that. You won't be much older, either. Perhaps Miss Eddy can tell you something about it. As to you, Eddie, you'll come back to me on your knees, do you hear, girl? On your knees, and then I'll tell you what your punishment may be. You've sowed, and by the Lord, I'll see that you reap." He glanced at them both in fury. Then he turned upon his heel, and an instant later the outer door had banged behind him. For a few moments McMurdo and the girl stood in silence. Then she threw her arms around him.
"Oh, Jack, how brave you were! But it is no use, you must fly! Tonight, Jack, tonight, it's your only hope! He will have your life. I read it in his horrible eyes. What chance have you against a dozen of them, with Boss McGinty and all the power of the lodge behind them?"
McMurdo disengaged her hands, kissed her, and gently pushed her back into a chair. "There, Acushla, there. Don't be disturbed or fear for me. I'm a freeman myself. I'm after telling your father about it. Maybe I am no better than the others, so don't make a saint of me. Perhaps you hate me too, now that I've told you as much."
"Hate you, Jack? While life lasts, I could never do that. I've heard that there is no harm in being a freeman anywhere but here, so why should I think the worse of you for that? But if you are a freeman, Jack, why should you not go down and make a friend of Boss McGinty? Oh, hurry, Jack, hurry! Get your word in first, or the hounds will be on your trail."
"I was thinking the same thing," said McMurdo. "I'll go right now and fix it. You can tell your father that I'll sleep here tonight and find some other quarters in the morning." The bar of McGinty's saloon was crowded, as usual, for it was the favourite loafing place of all the rougher elements of the town. The man was popular, for he had a rough, jovial disposition which formed a mask, covering a great deal which lay behind it. But apart from this popularity, the fear in which he was held throughout the township, and indeed down the whole 30 miles of the valley and past the mountains on each side of it, was enough in itself to fill his bar, for none could afford to neglect his goodwill. Besides those secret powers which it was universally believed that he exercised in so pitiless a fashion, he was a high public official, a municipal councillor, and a commissioner of roads, elected to the office through the votes of the ruffians who in turn expected to receive favours at his hands. Assessments and taxes were enormous. The public works were notoriously neglected. The accounts were slurred over by bribed auditors, and the decent citizen was terrorized into paying public blackmail and holding his tongue lest some worse thing befall him. Thus it was that year by year Boss McGinty's diamond pins became more obtrusive, his gold chains more weighty across a more gorgeous vest, and his saloon stretched farther and farther, until it threatened to absorb one whole side of the market square. McMurdo pushed open the swinging door of the saloon and made his way amid the crowd of men within through an atmosphere blurred with tobacco smoke and heavy with the smell of spirits. The place was brilliantly lighted, and the huge, heavily gilt mirrors upon every wall reflected and multiplied the garish illumination. There were several bartenders in their shirt sleeves, hard at work mixing drinks for the loungers who fringed the broad, brass-trimmed counter. At the far end, with his body resting upon the bar and a cigar stuck at an acute angle from the corner of his mouth, stood a tall, strong, heavily built man who could be none other than the famous McGinty himself. He was a black-maned giant, bearded to the cheekbones, with a shock of raven hair which fell to his collar. His complexion was as swarthy as that of an Italian, and his eyes were of a strange dead black, which, combined with a slight squint, gave them a particularly sinister appearance. All else in the man, his noble proportions, his fine features, and his frank bearing, fitted in with that jovial man-to-man manner which he affected. Here, one would say, is a bluff, honest fellow, whose heart would be sound, however rude his outspoken words might seem. It was only when those dead, dark eyes, deep and remorseless, were turned upon a man that he shrank within himself, feeling that he was face to face with an infinite possibility of latent evil, with a strength and courage and cunning behind it which made it a thousand times more deadly. Having had a good look at his man, McMurdo elbowed his way forward with his usual careless audacity and pushed himself through the little group of courtiers who were fawning upon the powerful boss, laughing uproariously at the smallest of his jokes. The young stranger's bold grey eyes looked back fearlessly through their glasses at the deadly black ones which turned sharply upon him.
"Well, young man, I can't call your face to mind.
I'm new here, Mr. McGinty."
"You're not so new that you can't give a gentleman his proper title."
"He's Counselor McGinty, young man," said a voice from the group.
"I'm sorry, Counselor. I'm strange to the ways of the place, but I was advised to see you." "Well, you see me. This is all there is. What do you think of me?"
"Well, it's early days. If your heart is as big as your body, and your soul as fine as your face, then I'd ask for nothing better," said McMurdo.
"By gar, you got an Irish tongue in your head, anyhow," cried the saloon-keeper, not quite certain whether to humour this audacious visitor or to stand upon his dignity.
"So you're good enough to pass my appearance?"
"Sure," said McMurdo.
"And you were told to see me?"
"I was."
"And who told you?"
"Brother Scanlon of Lodge 341 Vermissa. I drink your health, Counsellor, and to our better acquaintance." He raised a glass with which he had been served to his lips and elevated his little finger as he drank it. McGinty, who had been watching him narrowly, raised his thick black eyebrows.
"Oh, it's like that, is it?" said he. "I'll have to look a bit closer into this, Mr.
McMurdo."
"A bit closer, Mr. McMurdo, for we don't take folk on trust in these parts, nor believe all we're told, neither. Come in here for a moment, behind the bar."
There was a small room there, lined with barrels. McGinty carefully closed the door, and then seated himself on one of them, biting thoughtfully on his cigar and surveying his companion with those disquieting eyes. For a couple of minutes he sat in complete silence. McMurdo bore the inspection cheerfully, one hand in his coat pocket, the other twisting his brown moustache. Suddenly McGinty stooped and produced a wicked-looking revolver.
"See here, my joker," said he, "if I thought you were playing any game on us, it would be short work for you."
"This is a strange welcome," McMurdo answered with some dignity, "for the bodymaster of a lodge of freemen to give to a stranger brother."
"Aye, but it's just that same that you have to prove," said McGinty. "And God help you if you fail. Where were you made?"
"Lodge 29, Chicago."
"When?"
"June 24th, 1872.
"What bodymaster?"
"James H. Scott."
"Who is your district ruler?"
"Bartholomew Wilson."
"You seem glib enough in your tests. What are you doing here?"
"Working, the same as you, but a poorer job."
"You have your back answer quick enough."
"Yes, I was always quick of speech."
"Are you quick of action?"
"I have had that name among those that knew me best."
"Well, we may try you sooner than you think. Have you heard anything of the lodge in these parts?
I've heard that it takes a man to be a brother.
True for you, Mr. McMurdo. Why did you leave Chicago?
I'm damned if I'll tell you that.
McGinty opened his eyes. He was not used to being answered in such fashion, and it amused him.
Why won't you tell me?
Because no brother may tell another a lie.
Then the truth is too bad to tell?
You can put it that way if you like.
See here, mister. You can't expect me, as bodymaster, to pass into the lodge a man for whose past he can't answer.
McMurdo looked puzzled. Then he took a worn newspaper cutting from an inner pocket.
You wouldn't squeal on a fellow, said he. I'll wipe my hand across your face if you say such words to me, cried McGinty hotly.
You're right, Councillor, said McMurdo meekly. I should apologize. I spoke without thought. Well, I know that I'm safe in your hands. Look at that clipping.
McGinty glanced his eyes over the account of the shooting of one Jonas Pinto in the Lake Saloon, Market Street, Chicago, in the New Year week of 1874.
Your work? He asked as he handed back the paper.
McMurdo nodded.
Why did you shoot him?
I was helping Uncle Sam to make dollars. Maybe mine were not as good gold as his, but they looked as well and were cheaper to make. This man Pinto helped me to shove the queer.
To do what?
Well, it means to pass the dollars out into circulation. Then he said he would split. Maybe he did split. I didn't wait to see. I just killed him and lighted out for the coal country.
Why the coal country?
"'Cause I'd read in the papers that they weren't too particular in those parts.
McGinty laughed.
You were first a coiner and then a murderer, and you came to these parts because you thought you'd be welcome?
That's about the size of it, McMurdo answered.
Well, I guess you'll go far. Say, can you make those dollars yet?
McMurdo took half a dozen from his pocket.
Those never passed the Philadelphia Mint, said he.
You don't say.
McGinty held them to the light in his enormous hand, which was hairy as a gorilla's.
I can see no difference. You'll be a mighty useful brother, I'm thinking. We can do with a bad man or two among us, friend McMurdo, for there are times when we have to take our own part. We'd soon be against the wall if we didn't shove back at those that were pushing us.
Well, I guess I'll do my share of shoving with the rest of the boys.
You seem to have a good nerve. You didn't squirm when I shoved this gun at you. It was not me that was in danger.
Who, then?
It was you, Councillor. McMurdo drew a cocked pistol from the side pocket of his pea jacket.
I was covering you all the time. I guess my shot would have been as quick as yours.
By gah!
McGinty flushed an angry red and then burst into a roar of laughter.
Say, we've had no such holy terror come to hand this many a year. I reckon the lodge will learn to be proud of you. Well, what the hell do you want? Can't I speak alone with a gentleman for 5 minutes, but you must butt in on us?
The bartender stood abashed.
I'm sorry, Councillor, but it's Ted Baldwin. He says he must see you this very minute.
The message was unnecessary, for the set, cruel face of the man himself was looking over the servant's shoulder. He pushed the bartender out and closed the door on him.
So, said he, with a furious glance at McMurdo, you got here first, did you? I've a word to say to you, Councillor, about this man.
Then say it here and now, before my face, cried McMurdo.
I'll say it at my own time, in my own way.
Tut, tut, said McGinty, getting off his barrel. This will never do.
We have a new brother here, Baldwin, and it's not for us to greet him in such fashion. Hold out your hand, man, and make it up.
Never, cried Baldwin in a fury.
I've offered to fight him if he thinks I've wronged him, said McMurdo. I'll fight him with fists, or if that won't satisfy him, I'll fight him any other way he chooses. Now, I'll leave it to you, Councillor, to judge between us as a bodymaster should.
What is it, then?
A young lady. She's free to choose for herself.
Is she?
Cried Baldwin.
As between two brothers of the lodge, I should say that she was, said the boss.
Oh, that's your ruling, is it?
Yes, it is, Ted Baldwin, said McGinty with a wicked stare. Is it you that would dispute it?
You would throw over one that has stood by you this 5 years in favour of a man that you never saw before in your life? You're not bodymaster for life, Jack McGinty, and by God, when next it comes to a vote... The councillor sprang at him like a tiger. His hand closed round the other's neck, and he hurled him back across one of the barrels. In his mad fury, he would have squeezed the life out of him if McMurdo had not interfered.
"Easy, Councillor, for heaven's sake, go easy!" he cried, as he dragged him back.
McGinty released his hold, and Baldwin, cowed and shaken, gasping for breath, and shivering in every limb as one who has looked over the very edge of death, sat up on the barrel over which he had been hurled.
"You've been asking for it this many a day, Ted Baldwin. Now you've got it!" cried McGinty, his huge chest rising and falling. "Maybe you think if I was voted down from bodymaster, you would find yourself in my shoes. It's for the lodge to say that, but so long as I am the chief, I'll have no man lift his voice against me or my rulings."
"I have nothing against you," mumbled Baldwin, feeling his throat.
"Well, then," cried the other, relapsing in a moment into a bluff joviality. "We're all good friends again, and there is an end of the matter."
He took a bottle of champagne down from the shelf and twisted out the cork.
"See now," he continued, as he filled three high glasses, "let us drink the quarrelling toast of the lodge. After that, as you know, there can be no bad blood between us. Now then, the left hand on the apple of my throat. I say to you, Ted Baldwin, what is the offence, sir?"
"The clouds are heavy," answered Baldwin.
"But they will forever brighten,
and this I swear." The men drank their glasses, and the same ceremony was performed between Baldwin and McMurdo.
"There!" cried McGinty, rubbing his hands. "That's the end of the black blood. You come under lodge discipline if it goes further, and that's a heavy hand in these parts, as Brother Baldwin knows, and as you will damn soon find out, Brother McMurdo, if you ask for trouble."
"Faith, I'd be slow to do that," said McMurdo. He held out his hand to Baldwin. "I'm quick to quarrel and quick to forgive. It's my hot Irish blood, they tell me, but it's over for me, and I bear no grudge."
Baldwin had to take the proffered hand, for the baleful eye of the terrible boss was upon him, but his sullen face showed how little the words of the other had moved him.
McGinty clapped them both on the shoulders.
"Tut! These girls, he cried. "To think that the same petticoats should come between two of my boys. It's the devil's own luck. Well, it's the colleen inside of them that must settle the question, for it's outside the jurisdiction of a bodymaster, and the Lord be praised for that. We have enough on us without the women as well."
"You'll have to be affiliated to Lodge 341, Brother McMurdo. We have our own ways and methods, different from Chicago. Saturday night is our meeting, and if you'll come then, we'll make you free forever of the Vermissa Valley."
Chapter 3. Lodge 341, Vermissa. On the day following the evening which had contained so many exciting events, McMurdo moved his lodgings from old Jacob Shafter's and took up his quarters at the Widow McNamara's on the extreme outskirts of the town.
Scanlan, his original acquaintance aboard the train, had occasion shortly afterwards to move into Vermissa, and the two lodged together. There was no other boarder, and the hostess was an easy-going old Irishwoman who left them to themselves, so that they had a freedom for speech and action welcome to men who had secrets in common. Shafter had relented to the extent of letting McMurdo come to his meals there when he liked, so that his intercourse with Etty was by no means broken. On the contrary, it drew closer and more intimate as the weeks went by. In his bedroom at his new abode, McMurdo felt it safe to take out the coining moulds, and under many a pledge of secrecy, a number of brothers from the lodge were allowed to come in and see them, each carrying away in his pocket some examples of the false money, so cunningly struck that there was never the slightest difficulty or danger in passing it. Why, with such a wonderful art at his command, McMurdo should condescend to work at all was a perpetual mystery to his companions, though he made it clear to anyone who asked him that if he lived without any visible means, it would very quickly bring the police upon his track. One policeman was indeed after him already, but the incident, as luck would have it, did the adventurer a great deal more good than harm. After the first introduction, there were few evenings when he did not find his way to McGinty's saloon, there to make closer acquaintance with the boys, which was the jovial title by which the dangerous gang who infested the place were known to one another. His dashing manner and fearlessness of speech made him a favourite with them all, while the rapid and scientific way in which he polished off his antagonist in an all-in barroom scrap earned the respect of that rough community. Another incident, however, raised him even higher in their estimation. Just at the crowded hour one night, the door opened, and a man entered with the quiet blue uniform and peaked cap of the mine police. This was a special body raised by the railways and colliery owners to supplement the efforts of the ordinary civil police, who were perfectly helpless in the face of the organized ruffianism which terrorized the district. There was a hush as he entered, and many a curious glance was cast at him. But the relations between policemen and criminals are peculiar in some parts of the States, and McGinty himself, standing behind his counter, showed no surprise when the policeman enrolled himself among his customers.
"A straight whiskey, for the night is bitter," said the police officer.
"I don't think we've met before, Counselor."
"You'll be the new captain," said McGinty.
"That's so.
We're looking to you, Counselor, and to the other leading citizens, to help us in upholding law and order in this township. Captain Marvin is my name."
"We'd do better without you, Captain Marvin," said McGinty coldly, "for we have our own police of the township, and no need for any imported goods. What are you but the paid tool of the capitalists, hired by them to club or shoot your poorer fellow citizen?"
"Well, well, we won't argue about that," said the police officer good-humouredly. "I expect we all do our duty, same as we see it, but we can't all see it the same."
He had drunk off his glass and had turned to go when his eyes fell upon the face of Jack McMurdo, who was scowling at his elbow.
"Hello, hello," he cried, looking him up and down. "Here's an old acquaintance."
McMurdo shrank away from him.
"I was never a friend to you, nor any other cursed copper in my life," said he.
"An acquaintance isn't always a friend," said the police captain, grinning. "You're Jack McMurdo of Chicago, right enough, and don't you deny it."
McMurdo shrugged his shoulders. "I'm not denying it," said he. "Do you think I'm ashamed of my own name?"
"You got good cause to be, anyhow."
"What the devil do you mean by that?" he roared, with his fists clenched.
No, no, Jack, bluster won't do with me. I was an officer in Chicago before ever I came to this darned coal bunker, and I know a Chicago crook when I see one.
McMurdo's face fell.
Don't tell me that you're Marvin of the Chicago Central, he cried.
Just the same old Teddy Marvin, at your service. We haven't forgotten the shooting of Jonas Pinto up there.
I never shot him.
Did you not? That's good impartial evidence, ain't it? Well, his death came in uncommon handy for you, or they would have had you for shoving the queer. Well, we can let that be bygones, for between you and me, and perhaps I'm going further than my duty in saying it, they could get no clear case against you, and Chicago's open to you tomorrow. I'm very well where I am. Well, I've given you the pointer, and you're a sulky dog not to thank me for it.
Well, I suppose you mean well, and I do thank you, said McMurdo in no very gracious manner.
It's mum with me, so long as I see you living on the straight, said the captain. But by the Lord, if you get off after this, it's another story. So good night to you, and good night, counselor.
He left the barroom, but not before he had created a local hero. McMurdo's deeds in far Chicago had been whispered before. He had put off all questions with a smile, as one who did not wish to have greatness thrust upon him. But now the thing was officially confirmed. The bar loafers crowded round him and shook him heartily by the hand. He was free of the community from that time on. He could drink hard and show little trace of it, but that evening, had his mate Scanlan not been at hand to lead him home, the fated hero would surely have spent his night under the bar. On a Saturday night, McMurdo was introduced to the lodge. He had thought to pass in without ceremony as being an initiate of Chicago, but there were particular rites in Vermissa of which they were proud, and these had to be undergone by every postulant. The assembly met in a large room reserved for such purposes at the Union House. Some 60 members assembled at Vermissa, but that by no means represented the full strength of the organization, for there were several other lodges in the valley, and others across the mountains on each side, who exchanged members when any serious business was afoot, so that a crime might be done by men who were strangers to the locality. Altogether, there were not less than 500 scattered over the coal district. In the bare assembly room, the men were gathered round a long table. At the side was a second one, laden with bottles and glasses, on which some members of the company were already turning their eyes. McGinty sat at the head with a flat black velvet cap upon his shock of tangled black hair, and a coloured purple stole round his neck, so that he seemed to be a priest presiding over some diabolical ritual. To right and left of him were the higher lodge officials, the cruel, handsome face of Ted Baldwin among them. Each of these wore some scarf or medallion as emblem of his office. They were, for the most part, men of mature age, but the rest of the company consisted of young fellows from 18 to 25, the ready and capable agents who carried out the commands of their seniors. Among the older men were many whose features showed the tigerish, lawless souls within, but looking at the rank and file, it was difficult to believe that these eager and open-faced young fellows were in very truth a dangerous gang of murderers, whose minds had suffered such complete moral perversion that they took a horrible pride in their proficiency at the business, and looked with deepest respect at the man who had the reputation of making what they called a clean job. To their contorted natures, it had become a spirited and chivalrous thing to volunteer for service against some man who had never injured them, and whom in many cases they had never seen in their lives.
the crime committed, they quarrelled as to who had actually struck the fatal blow and amused one another and the company by describing the cries and contortions of the murdered man. At first they had shown some secrecy in their arrangements, but at the time which this narrative describes, their proceedings were extraordinarily open, for the repeated failure of the law had proved to them that, on the one hand, no one would dare to witness against them, and on the other, they had an unlimited number of staunch witnesses upon whom they could call, and a well-filled treasure chest from which they could draw the funds to engage the best legal talent in the state. In 10 long years of outrage, there had been no single conviction, and the only danger that ever threatened the Scourers lay in the victim himself, who, however outnumbered and taken by surprise, might, and occasionally did, leave his mark upon his assailants. McMurdo had been warned that some ordeal lay before him, but no one would tell him in what it consisted. He was led now into an outer room by 2 solemn brothers. Through the plank partition he could hear the murmur of many voices from the assembly within. Once or twice he caught the sound of his own name, and he knew that they were discussing his candidacy. Then there entered an inner guard with a green and gold sash across his chest. "The bodymaster orders that he shall be trussed, blinded, and entered," said he. The 3 of them removed his coat, turned up the sleeve of his right arm, and finally passed a rope round above the elbows and made it fast. They next placed a thick black cap right over his head and the upper part of his face, so that he could see nothing. He was then led into the assembly hall. It was pitch dark and very oppressive under his hood. He heard the rustle and murmur of the people round him, and then the voice of McGinty sounded dull and distant through the covering of his ears.
"John McMurdo," said the voice, "are you already a member of the ancient order of freemen?"
He bowed in assent.
"Is your lodge number 29, Chicago?"
He bowed again.
"Dark nights are unpleasant," said the voice.
"Yes, for strangers to travel," he answered.
"The clouds are heavy."
"Yes, a storm is approaching."
"Are the brethren satisfied?"
asked the bodymaster. There was a general murmur of assent.
"We know, brother, by your sign and by your countersign, that you are indeed one of us," said McGinty. "We would have you know, however, that in this county, and in other counties of these parts, we have certain rights, and also certain duties of our own, which call for good men. Are you ready to be tested?"
"I am."
"Are you of stout heart?"
"I am."
"Take a stride forward to prove it."
As the words were said, he felt 2 hard points in front of his eyes pressing upon them, so that it appeared as if he could not move forward without a danger of losing them. Nonetheless, he nerved himself to step resolutely out, and as he did so, the pressure melted away. There was a low murmur of applause.
"He is of stout heart," said the voice. "Can you bear pain?"
"As well as another," he answered.
"Test him."
It was all he could do to keep himself from screaming out, for an agonizing pain shot through his forearm. He nearly fainted at the sudden shock of it, but he bit his lip and clenched his hands to hide his agony.
"I can take more than that," said he.
This time there was loud applause. A finer first appearance had never been made in the lodge. Hands clapped him on the back, and the hood was plucked from his head. He stood, blinking and smiling amid the congratulations of the brothers.
"One last word, Brother McMurdo," said McGinty. "You have already sworn the oath of secrecy and fidelity, and you are aware that the punishment for any breach of it is instant
an inevitable death?
I am, said McMurdo.
And you accept the rule of the bodymaster for the time being under all circumstances?
I do.
Then, in the name of Lodge 341 Vermissor, I welcome you to its privileges and debates. You will put the liquor on the table, Brother Scanlan, and we will drink to our worthy brother.
McMurdo's coat had been brought to him, but before putting it on, he examined his right arm, which still smarted heavily. There, on the flesh of the forearm, was a circle with a triangle within it, deep and red as the branding iron had left it. One or two of his neighbours pulled up their sleeves and showed their own lodge marks.
"We've all had it," said one, "but not all as brave as you over it."
"Tot, it was nothing," said he, "but it burned and ached all the same." When the drinks which followed the ceremony of initiation had all been disposed of, the business of the lodge proceeded. McMurdo, accustomed only to the prosaic performances of Chicago, listened with open ears and more surprise than he ventured to show to what followed.
"The first business on the agenda paper," said McGinty, "is to read the following letter from Division Master Windle of Merton County Lodge 249. He says, 'Dear Sir, there is a job to be done on Andrew Ray of Ray and Sturmash, coal owners near this place. You will remember that your lodge owes us a return, having had the service of two brethren in the matter of the patrolman last fall. You will send two good men. They will be taken charge of by Treasurer Higgins of this lodge, whose address you know. He will show them when to act and where. Yours in freedom, J. W. Windle, D.M.A.O.F. Windle has never refused us when we have had occasion to ask for the loan of a man or two, and it is not for us to refuse him."
McGinty paused and looked round the room with his dull, malevolent eyes.
"Who will volunteer for the job?"
Several young fellows held up their hands. The bodymaster looked at them with an approving smile.
"You'll do, Tiger Cormac. If you handle it as well as you did the last, you won't be wrong. And you, Wilson."
"I've no pistol," said the volunteer, a mere boy in his teens.
"It's your first, is it not? Well, you have to be blooded sometime. It will be a great start for you. As to the pistol, you'll find it waiting for you, or I'm mistaken. If you report yourselves on Monday, it will be time enough. You'll get a great welcome when you return."
"Any reward this time?"
asked Cormac, a thick-set, dark-faced, brutal-looking young man whose ferocity had earned him the nickname of Tiger.
"Never mind the reward. You just do it for the honor of the thing. Maybe when it is done there will be a few odd dollars at the bottom of the box."
"What has the man done?"
asked young Wilson.
"Sure, it's not for the likes of you to ask what the man has done. He is being judged over there. That's no business of ours. All we have to do is carry it out for them, same as they would for us. Speaking of that, two brothers from the Merton Lodge are coming over to us next week to do some business in this quarter."
"Who are they?" asked someone.
"Faith, it is wiser not to ask. If you know nothing, you can testify nothing, and no trouble can come of it. But they're men who will make a clean job when they are about it."
"And time, too," cried Ted Baldwin. "Folk are getting out of hand in these parts. It was only last week that three of our men were turned off by Foreman Blaker. It's been owing him a long time, and he'll get it full and proper."
"Get what?" McMurdo whispered to his neighbour.
"The business end of a buckshot cartridge," cried the man with a loud laugh.
"What think you of our ways, brother?"
McMurdo's criminal soul seemed to have already absorbed the spirit of the vile association of which he was now a member.
"I like it well," said he. "'Tis a proper place for a lad of mettle."
Several of those who sat around heard his words and applauded them.
"What's that?"
cried the black-maned bodymaster from the end of the table.
"'Tis our new brother, sir, who finds our ways to his taste.'
McMurdo rose to his feet for an instant. "'I would say, eminent bodymaster, that if a man should be wanted, I should take it as an honour to be chosen to help the lodge.' There was great applause at this. It was felt that a new sun was pushing its rim over the horizon. To some of the elders, it seemed that the progress was a little too rapid.
"'I would move,' said the secretary, Harroway, a vulture-faced old greybeard who sat near the chairman, "'that Brother McMurdo should wait until it is the good pleasure of the lodge to employ him.'
"'Sure, that was what I meant.' "'I'm in your hands,' said McMurdo.
"'Your time will come, brother,' said the chairman. "'We have marked you down as a willing man, "'and we believe that you will do good work in these parts. "'There is a small matter tonight in which you may take a hand, "'if it so please you. "'I will wait for something that is worthwhile. "'You can come tonight anyhow, "'and it will help you to know what we stand for in this community. "'I will make the announcement later.' Meanwhile, he glanced at his agenda paper, I have one or two more points to bring before the meeting. First of all, I will ask the treasurer as to our bank balance. There is the pension to Jim Carnaway's widow. He was struck down doing the work of the lodge, and it is for us to see that she is not the loser.
Jim was shot last month when they tried to kill Chester Wilcox of Marley Creek, McMurdo's neighbor informed him.
"'The funds are good at the moment,' said the treasurer, with the bank book in front of him. "'The firms have been generous of late. Max Linder and Co. paid $500 to be left alone. Walker Brothers sent in $100, but I took in on myself to return it and ask for $5. If I do not hear by Wednesday, their winding gear may get out of order. We had to burn their breaker last year before they became reasonable.' Then the West Section Coaling Company has paid its annual contribution. We have enough on hand to meet any obligations.
How about Archie Swindon? Asked a brother.
He has sold out and left the district. The old devil left a note for us to say that he'd rather be a free crossing sweeper in New York than a large mine owner under the power of a ring of blackmailers. By gar, it was as well that he made a break for it before the note reached us. I guess he won't show his face in this valley again.
An elderly, clean-shaved man with a kindly face and a good brow rose from the end of the table which faced the chairman.
"'Mr. Treasurer,' he asked, "'may I ask who has bought the property of this man that we have driven out of the district?'
"'Yes, Brother Morris, it has been bought by the State and Merton County Railroad Company.'
"'And who bought the mines of Todman and of Lee that came into the market in the same way last year?'
"'The same company, Brother Morris.'
"'And who bought the ironworks of Manson and of Schumann and of Van Dare and of Atwood, which have been given up of late?'
"'They were all bought by the West Gilmerton General Mining Company.'
"'I don't see, Brother Morris,' said the chairman, "'that it matters to us who buys them, "'since they can't carry them out of the district.'
"'With all respect to you, eminent bodymaster, "'I think it may matter very much to us. "'This process has been going on now for 10 long years. "'We are gradually driving all the small men out of trade. "'What is the result? "'We find in their places great companies like the Railroad or the General Iron, who have their directors in New York or Philadelphia, and care nothing for our threats. We can take it out of their local bosses, but it only means that others will be sent in their stead, and we are making it dangerous for ourselves. The small men could not harm us. They had not the money nor the power. So long as we did not squeeze them too dry, they would stay on under our power. But if these big companies find that we stand between them and their profits, they will spare no pains and no expense to hunt us down and bring us to court.
There was a hush at these ominous words, and every face darkened as gloomy looks were exchanged.
So omnipotent and unchallenged had they been that the very thought that there was possible retribution in the background had been banished from their minds, and yet the idea struck a chill to the most reckless of them. "It is my advice," the speaker continued, "that we go easier upon the small men. On the day that they have all been driven out, the power of this society will have been broken." Unwelcome truths are not popular. There were angry cries as the speaker resumed his seat. McGinty rose with gloom upon his brow.
"Brother Morris," said he, "you were always a croaker. So long as the members of this lodge stand together, there is no power in the United States that can touch them. Sure, have we not tried it often enough in the law courts? I expect the big companies will find it easier to pay than to fight, same as the little companies do. And now, brethren," McGinty took off his black velvet cap and his stole as he spoke, "this lodge has finished its business for the evening, save for one small matter, which may be mentioned when we are parting. The time has now come for fraternal refreshment and for harmony."
Strange indeed is human nature. Here were these men, to whom murder was familiar, who again and again had struck down the father of the family, some man against whom they had no personal feeling, without one thought of compunction or of compassion for his weeping wife or helpless children, and yet the tender or pathetic in music could move them to tears. McMurdo had a fine tenor voice, and if he had failed to gain the goodwill of the lodge before, it could no longer have been withheld after he had thrilled them with "I'm Sitting on the Stile, Mary," and "On the Banks of Allan Water." In his very first night, the new recruit had made himself one of the most popular of the brethren, marked already for advancement and high office. There were other qualities needed, however, besides those of good fellowship, to make a worthy freeman, and of these he was given an example before the evening was over. The whiskey bottle had passed round many times, and the men were flushed and ripe for mischief when their bodymaster rose once more to address them.
"Boys," said he, "there is one man in this town that wants trimming up, and it's for you to see that he gets it. I'm speaking of James Stanger of the Herald. You've seen how he's been opening his mouth against us again."
There was a murmur of assent, with many a muttered oath. McGinty took a slip of paper from his waistcoat pocket.
"Law and order. That's how he heads it. Reign of terror in the coal and iron district. 12 years have now elapsed since the first assassinations which proved the existence of a criminal organization in our midst. From that day, these outrages have never ceased until now they have reached a pitch which makes us the opprobrium of the civilized world. Is it for such results as this that our great country welcomes to its bosom the alien who flies from the despotisms of Europe? Is it that they shall themselves become tyrants over the very men who have given them shelter, and that a state of terrorism and lawlessness should be established under the very shadow of the sacred folds of the starry flag of freedom, which would raise horror in our minds if we read of it as existing under the most effete monarchy of the East? The men are known. The organization is patent and public. How long are we to endure it? Can we forever live?" "Sure, I've read enough of the slush," cried the chairman, tossing the paper down upon the table. "That's what he says of us. The question I'm asking you is, what shall we say to him?" "Kill him!" cried a dozen fierce voices.
"I protest against that," said Brother Morris, the man of the good brow and shaved face. "I tell you, brethren, that our hand is too heavy in this valley, and that there will come a point where in self-defense every man will unite to crush us out.
James Stanger is an old man. He is respected in the township and the district. His paper stands for all that is solid in the valley. If that man is struck down, there will be a stir through this state that will only end with our destruction.
And how would they bring about our destruction, Mr. Standback? Cried McGinty. Is it by the police? Sure, half of them are in our pay, and half of them is afraid of us. Or is it by the law courts and the judge? Haven't we tried that before now, and whatever came of it?
There is a Judge Lynch that might try the case, said Brother Morris. A general shout of anger greeted the suggestion.
I have but to raise my finger, cried McGinty, and I could put 200 men into this town that would clear it out from end to end.
Then suddenly raising his voice and bending his huge black brows into a terrible frown,
See here, Brother Morris, I have my eye on you, and have had for some time. You've no heart yourself, and you try to take the heart out of others. It will be an ill day for you, Brother Morris, when your own name comes on our agenda paper, and I'm thinking that it's just there that I ought to place it.
Morris had turned deadly pale, and his knees seemed to give way under him as he fell back into his chair. He raised his glass in his trembling hand and drank before he could answer. I apologize, eminent bodymaster, to you and to every brother in this lodge, if I have said more than I should. I am a faithful member. You all know that. And it is my fear lest evil come to the lodge, which makes me speak in anxious words. But I have greater trust in your judgment than in my own, eminent bodymaster, and I promise you that I will not offend again. The bodymaster's scowl relaxed as he listened to the humble words.
Very good, Brother Morris. It's myself that would be sorry if it were needful to give you a lesson. But so long as I am in this chair, we shall be a united lodge in word and in deed. And now, boys, he continued, looking round at the company, I'll say this much, that if Stanger got his full deserts, there would be more trouble than we need ask for. These editors hang together, and every journal in the state would be crying out for police and troops. But I guess you can give him a pretty severe warning. Will you fix it, Brother Baldwin?
Sure, said the young man eagerly.
How many will you take?
Half a dozen and two to guard the door. You'll come, Gower, and you, Mansell, and you, Scanlon, and the two Willoughbys.
I promised the new brother he should go, said the chairman.
Ted Baldwin looked at McMurdo with eyes which showed that he had not forgotten nor forgiven.
Well, he can come if he wants, he said in a surly voice. That's enough. The sooner we get to work, the better.
The company broke up with shouts and yells and snatches of drunken song. The bar was still crowded with revellers, and many of the brethren remained there. The little band, who had been told off for duty, passed out into the street, proceeding in twos and threes along the sidewalk so as not to provoke attention. It was a bitterly cold night, with a half-moon shining brilliantly in a frosty, star-spangled sky. The men stopped and gathered in a yard which faced a high building. The words Vermissa Herald were printed in gold lettering between the brightly lit windows. From within came the clanking of the printing press.
Here you, said Baldwin to McMurdo, you can stand below at the door and see that the road is kept open for us. Arthur Willoughby can stay with you. You others, come with me. Have no fears, boys, for we have a dozen witnesses that we're in the Union Bar at this very moment.
It was nearly midnight, and the street was deserted, save for one or two revellers upon their way home. The party crossed the road, and pushing open the door of the newspaper office, Baldwin and his men rushed in and up the stair which faced them. McMurdo and another remained below.
From the room above came a shout, a cry for help, and then the sound of trampling feet and of falling chairs. An instant later, a grey-haired man rushed out on the landing. He was seized before he could get farther, and his spectacles came tinkling down to McMurdo's feet. There was a thud and a groan. He was on his face, and half a dozen sticks were clattering together as they fell upon him. He writhed, and his long, thin limbs quivered under the blows. The others ceased at last, but Baldwin, his cruel face set in an infernal smile, was hacking at the man's head, which he vainly endeavoured to defend with his arms. His white hair was dabbled with patches of blood. Baldwin was still stooping over his victim, putting in a short, vicious blow whenever he could see a part exposed, when McMurdo dashed up the stair and pushed him back. "You'll kill the man," said he. "Drop it!" Baldwin looked at him in amazement. "Curse you!" he cried. "Who are you to interfere? You that are new to the lodge, stand back!" He raised his stick, but McMurdo had whipped his pistol out of his pocket. "Stand back yourself!" he cried. "I'll blow your face in if you lay a hand on me. As to the lodge, wasn't it the order of the bodymaster that the man was not to be killed? And what are you doing but killing him?" "It's truth, he says," remarked one of the men. "By gar, you best hurry yourselves!" cried the man below. "The windows are all lighting up, and you'll have the whole town here inside of 5 minutes." There was indeed the sound of shouting in the street, and a little group of compositors and pressmen was forming in the hall below and nerving itself to action. Leaving the limp and motionless body of the editor at the head of the stair, the criminals rushed down and made their way swiftly along the street. Having reached the Union House, some of them mixed with the crowd in McGinty's saloon, whispering across the bar to the boss that the job had been well carried through. Others, and among them McMurdo, broke away into side streets, and so by devious paths to their own homes. Chapter 4. The Valley of Fear. When McMurdo awoke next morning, he had good reason to remember his initiation into the lodge. His head ached with the effect of the drink, and his arm, where he had been branded, was hot and swollen. Having his own peculiar source of income, he was irregular in his attendance at his work, so he had a late breakfast and remained at home for the morning, writing a long letter to a friend. Afterwards, he read the Daily Herald. In a special column put in at the last moment, he read, "Outrage at the Herald office. Editor seriously injured." It was a short account of the facts with which he was himself more familiar than the writer could have been. It ended with the statement, "The matter is now in the hands of the police, but it can hardly be hoped that their exertions will be attended by any better results than in the past. Some of the men were recognized, and there is hope that a conviction may be obtained. The source of the outrage was, it need hardly be said, that infamous society which has held this community in bondage for so long a period, and against which the Herald has taken so uncompromising a stand. Mr. Stanger's many friends will rejoice to hear that, though he has been cruelly and brutally beaten, and though he has sustained severe injuries about the head, there is no immediate danger to his life." Below, it stated that a guard of police, armed with Winchester rifles, had been requisitioned for the defence of the office. McMurdo had laid down the paper and was lighting his pipe with a hand which was shaky from the excesses of the previous evening, when there was a knock outside, and his landlady brought to him a note which had just been handed in by a lad. It was unsigned and ran thus: "I should wish to speak to you, but would rather not do so in your house. You will find me beside the flagstaff upon Miller Hill. If you will come there now, I have something which it is important for you to hear and for me to say." McMurdo read the note twice with the utmost surprise, for he could not imagine what it meant or who was the author of it. Had it been in a feminine hand, he might have imagined that it was the beginning of one of those adventures which had been familiar enough in his past life, but it was the writing of a man, and of a well-educated one, too. Finally, after some hesitation, he determined to see the matter through. Miller Hill is an ill-kept public park in the very centre of the town. In summer, it is a favourite resort of the people, but in winter it is desolate enough. From the top of it, one has a view not only of the whole straggling, grimy town, but of the winding valley beneath, with its scattered mines and factories blackening the snow on each side of it, and of the wooded and white-capped ranges flanking it. McMurdo strolled up the winding path, hedged in with evergreens, until he reached the deserted restaurant, which forms the centre of summer gaiety. Beside it was a bare flagstaff, and underneath it a man, his hat drawn down and the collar of his overcoat turned up. When he turned his face, McMurdo saw that it was Brother Morris, he who had incurred the anger of the bodymaster the night before. The lodge sign was given and exchanged as they met. "I wanted to have a word with you, Mr. McMurdo," said the older man, speaking with a hesitation which showed that he was on delicate ground. "It was kind of you to come. Why did you not put your name to the note?"
"One has to be cautious, mister. One never knows in times like these how a thing may come back to one. One never knows either who to trust or who not to trust."
"Surely one may trust brothers of the lodge."
"No, no, not always," cried Morris with vehemence. "Whatever we say, even what we think, seems to go back to that man McGinty."
"Look here," said McMurdo sternly. "It was only last night, as you know well, that I swore good faith to our bodymaster. Would you be asking me to break my oath?"
"If that is the view you take," said Morris sadly, "I can only say that I am sorry I gave you the trouble to come and meet me. Things have come to a bad pass when two free citizens cannot speak their thoughts to each other."
McMurdo, who had been watching his companion very narrowly, relaxed somewhat in his bearing. "Sure, I spoke for myself only," said he. "I am a newcomer, as you know, and I am strange to it all. It is not for me to open my mouth, Mr. Morris, and if you think well to say anything to me, I am here to hear it."
"And to take back to Boss McGinty," said Morris bitterly.
"Indeed, then, you do me injustice there," cried McMurdo. "For myself, I am loyal to the lodge, and so I tell you straight. But I would be a poor creature if I were to repeat to any other what you might say to me in confidence. It will go no further than me, though I warn you that you may get neither help nor sympathy."
"I have given up looking for either the one or the other," said Morris. "I may be putting my very life in your hands by what I say, but bad as you are, and it seemed to me last night that you were shaping to be as bad as the worst, still you are new to it, and your conscience cannot yet be as hardened as theirs. That was why I thought to speak with you.
Well, what have you to say?"
"If you give me away, may a curse be on you."
"Sure, I said I would not."
"I would ask you, then, when you joined the Freeman's Society in Chicago, and swore vows of charity and fidelity, did ever it cross your mind that you might find it would lead you to crime?"
"If you call it crime," McMurdo answered.
"Call it crime!" cried Morris, his voice vibrating with passion.
"You have seen little of it if you can call it anything else. Was it crime last night when a man old enough to be your father was beaten till the blood dripped from his white hairs? Was that crime? Or what else would you call it?"
"There are some would say it was war," said McMurdo. "A war of two classes, with all in, so that each struck as best it could."
"Well,
Did you think of such a thing when you joined the Freeman Society at Chicago?
No, I'm bound to say I did not.
Nor did I when I joined it at Philadelphia. It was just a benefit club and a meeting place for one's fellows. Then I heard of this place, curse the hour that the name first fell upon my ears, and I came to better myself. My God, to better myself. My wife and three children came with me. I started a dry goods store on Market Square, and I prospered well. The word had gone round that I was a freeman, and I was forced to join the local lodge, same as you did last night. I have the badge of shame on my forearm and something worse branded on my heart. I found that I was under the orders of a black villain and caught in a meshwork of crime. What could I do? Every word I said to make things better was taken as treason, same as it was last night. I can't get away, for all I have in the world is in my store. If I leave the society, I know well that it means murder to me, and God knows what to my wife and children. Oh, man, it's awful, awful. He put his hands to his face, and his body shook with convulsive sobs. McMurdo shrugged his shoulders.
You were too soft for the job, said he. You're the wrong sort for such work.
I had a conscience and a religion, but they made me a criminal among them. I was chosen for a job. If I backed down, I knew well what would come to me. Maybe I'm a coward. Maybe it's the thought of my poor little woman and the children that makes me one. Anyhow, I went. I guess it will haunt me forever. It was a lonely house 20 miles from here, over the range yonder. I was told off for the door, same as you were last night. They could not trust me with the job. The others went in. When they came out, their hands were crimson to the wrists. As we turned away, a child was screaming out of the house behind us. It was a boy of 5 who had seen his father murdered. I nearly fainted with the horror of it. Yet I had to keep a bold and smiling face, for well I knew that if I did not, it would be out of my house that they would come next with their bloody hands, and it would be my little Fred that would be screaming for his father. But I was a criminal then, part sharer in a murder, lost forever in this world, and lost also in the next. I'm a good Catholic, but the priest would have no word with me when he heard I was a scourer, and I am excommunicated from my faith. That's how it stands with me. And I see you going down the same road, and I ask you what the end is to be. Are you ready to be a cold-blooded murderer also, or can we do anything to stop it?
What would you do? Asked McMurdo abruptly.
You would not inform.
God forbid, cried Morris. Sure, the very thought would cost me my life.
That's well, said McMurdo. I'm thinking that you are a weak man. You make too much of the matter.
Too much? Wait till you have lived here longer. Look down the valley. See the cloud of 100 chimneys that overshadows it. I tell you that the cloud of murder hangs thicker and lower than that over the heads of the people. It is the valley of fear, the valley of death. The terror is in the hearts of the people from the dusk to the dawn. Wait, young man, and you will learn for yourself.
Well, I'll let you know what I think when I've seen more, said McMurdo carelessly. What is very clear is that you are not the man for the place, and that the sooner you sell out, if you only get a dime a dollar for what the business is worth, the better it will be for you. What you have said is safe with me, but by gar, if I thought you were an informer.
No, no, cried Morris piteously.
Well, let it rest at that.
I'll bear what you have said in mind, and maybe some day I'll come back to it. I expect you meant kindly by speaking to me like this. Now, I'll be getting home.
One word before you go, said Morris. We may have been seen together. They may want to know what we have spoken about.
Ah, that's well thought of.
I offer you a clerkship in my store.
And I refuse it. That's our business.
Well, so long, Brother Morris, and may you find things go better with you in the future. That same afternoon, as McMurdo sat smoking, lost in thought beside the stove of his sitting room, the door swung open and its framework was filled with the huge figure of Boss McGinty. He passed the sign, and then, seating himself opposite to the young man, he looked at him steadily for some time, a look which was as steadily returned.
"I'm not much of a visitor, Brother McMurdo," he said at last. "I guess I'm too busy over the folk that visit me. I thought I'd stretch a point and drop down to see you in your own house."
"I'm proud to see you here, Councillor," McMurdo answered heartily, bringing his whiskey bottle out of the cupboard. "It's an honour that I'd not expected."
"How's the arm?" asked the boss.
McMurdo made a wry face. "Well, I'm not forgetting it," he said, "but it's worth it."
"Yes, it's worth it," the other answered, "to those that are loyal and go through with it and are a help to the lodge. What were you speaking to Brother Morris about on Miller Hill this morning?"
The question came so suddenly that it was well that he had his answer prepared. He burst into a hearty laugh. "Morris didn't know I could earn a living here at home. He shan't know either, for he has got too much conscience for the likes of me. But he's a good-hearted old chap. It was his idea that I was at a loose end, and that he would do me a good turn by offering me a clerkship in a dry goods store."
"Oh, that was it?"
"Yes, that was it."
"And you refused it?"
"Sure. Couldn't I earn 10 times as much in my own bedroom with 4 hours' work?"
"That's so. But I wouldn't get about too much with Morris."
"Why not?"
"Well, I guess because I tell you not. That's enough for most folk in these parts."
"It may be enough for most folk, but it ain't enough for me, Councillor," said McMurdo boldly. "If you're a judge of men, you'll know that." The swarthy giant glared at him, and his hairy paw closed for an instant round the glass as though he would hurl it at the head of his companion. Then he laughed in his loud, boisterous, insincere fashion.
"You're a queer card for sure," said he. "Well, if you want reasons, I'll give them. Did Morris say nothing to you against the lodge?"
"No."
"Nor against me?"
"No."
"Well, that's because he daren't trust you. But in his heart, he is not a loyal brother. We know that well, so we watch him, and we wait for the time to admonish him. I'm thinking that the time is drawing near. There's no room for scabby sheep in our pen, but if you keep company with a disloyal man, we might think that you were disloyal too, see?"
"There's no chance of my keeping company with him, for I dislike the man," McMurdo answered. "As to being disloyal, if it was any man but you, he would not use the word to me twice."
"Well, that's enough," said McGinty, draining off his glass. "I came down to give you a word in season, and you've had it."
"I'd like to know," said McMurdo, "how you ever came to learn that I had spoken with Morris at all."
McGinty laughed. "It's my business to know what goes on in this township," said he. "I guess you'd best reckon on my hearing all that passes. Well, time's up, and I'll just say—"
But his leave-taking was cut short in a very unexpected fashion. With a sudden crash, the door flew open, and 3 frowning, intent faces glared in at them from under the peaks of police caps. McMurdo sprang to his feet and half drew his revolver, but his arms stopped midway as he became conscious that 2 Winchester rifles were levelled at his head. A man in uniform advanced into the room, a 6-shooter in his hand. It was Captain Marvin, once of Chicago and now of the Mine Constabulary. He shook his head with a half-smile at McMurdo.
"I thought you'd be getting into trouble, Mr. Crooked McMurdo of Chicago," said he. "Can't keep out of it, can you? Take your hat. Come along with us." "I guess you'll pay for this, Captain Marvin," said McGinty. "Who are you, I'd like to know, to break into a house in this fashion and molest honest, law-abiding men?"
"You're standing out in this deal, Counselor McGinty," said the police captain. "We're not out after you, but after this man McMurdo. It is for you to help, not to hinder us in our duty."
"He's a friend of mine, and I'll answer for his conduct," said the boss.
"By all accounts, Mr. McGinty, you may have to answer for your own conduct some of these days," the captain answered. "This man McMurdo was a crook before ever he came here, and he's a crook still. Cover him, patrolman, while I disarm him."
"There's my pistol," said McMurdo coolly. "Maybe, Captain Marvin, if you and I were alone and face to face, you would not take me so easily." "Where's your warrant?" asked McGinty. "By gar! A man might as well live in Russia as in Vermissa while folk like you are running the police. It's a capitalist outrage, and you'll hear more of it, I reckon."
"You do what you think is your duty the best way you can, Counselor. We'll look after ours."
"What am I accused of?" asked McMurdo.
"Of being concerned in the beating of old editor Stanger at the Herald office. It wasn't your fault that there isn't a murder charge."
"Well, if that's all you have against him," cried McGinty with a laugh, "you can save yourself a deal of trouble by dropping it right now. This man was with me, in my saloon, playing poker up to midnight, and I can bring a dozen to prove it."
"That's your affair, and I guess you can settle it in court tomorrow. Meanwhile, come on, McMurdo, and come quietly, if you don't want a gun across your head. You stand wide, Mr. McGinty, for I warn you, I will stand no resistance when I'm on duty." So determined was the appearance of the captain that both McMurdo and his boss were forced to accept the situation. The latter managed to have a few whispered words with the prisoner before they parted.
"What about?"
He jerked his thumb upward to signify the coining plant. "All right," whispered McMurdo, who had devised a safe hiding place under the floor.
"I'll bid you goodbye," said the boss, shaking hands. "I'll see Riley the lawyer and take the defense upon myself. Take my word for it that they won't be able to hold you."
"I wouldn't bet on that. Guard the prisoner, you two, and shoot him if he tries any games. I'll search the house before I leave." He did so, but apparently found no trace of the concealed plant. When he had descended, he and his men escorted McMurdo to headquarters. Darkness had fallen, and a keen blizzard was blowing, so that the streets were nearly deserted. But a few loiterers followed the group, and, emboldened by invisibility, shouted imprecations at the prisoner.
"Lynch the cursed scourer!" they cried. "Lynch him!"
They laughed and jeered as he was pushed into the police station. After a short, formal examination from the inspector in charge, he was put into the common cell. Here he found Baldwin and three other criminals of the night before, all arrested that afternoon and waiting their trial next morning. But even within this inner fortress of the law, the long arm of the freeman was able to extend. Late at night there came a jailer with a straw bundle for their bedding, out of which he extracted two bottles of whiskey, some glasses, and a pack of cards. They spent a hilarious night, without an anxious thought as to the ordeal of the morning. Nor had they cause, as the result was to show. The magistrate could not possibly, on the evidence, have held them for a higher court. On the one hand, the compositors and pressmen were forced to admit that the light was uncertain, that they were themselves much perturbed, and that it was difficult for them to swear to the identity of the assailants, although they believed that the accused were among them. Cross-examined by the clever attorney who had been engaged by McGinty, they were even more nebulous in their evidence.
The injured man had already deposed that he was so taken by surprise by the suddenness of the attack that he could state nothing beyond the fact that the first man who struck him wore a moustache. He added that he knew them to be Scourers, since no one else in the community could possibly have any enmity to him, and he had long been threatened on account of his outspoken editorials. On the other hand, it was clearly shown by the united and unfaltering evidence of 6 citizens, including that high municipal official, Councillor McGinty, that the men had been at a card party at the Union House until an hour very much later than the commission of the outrage. Needless to say that they were discharged with something very near to an apology from the bench for the inconvenience to which they had been put, together with an implied censure of Captain Marvin and the police for their officious zeal. The verdict was greeted with loud applause by a court in which McMurdo saw many familiar faces. Brothers of the lodge smiled and waved, but there were others who sat with compressed lips and brooding eyes as the men filed out of the dock. One of them, a little dark-bearded, resolute fellow, put the thoughts of himself and comrades into words as the ex-prisoners passed him. "You damned murderers," he said. "We'll fix you yet." Chapter 5. The Darkest Hour. If anything had been needed to give an impetus to Jack McMurdo's popularity among his fellows, it would have been his arrest and acquittal. That a man, on the very night of joining the lodge, should have done something which brought him before the magistrate was a new record in the annals of the society. Already he had earned the reputation of a good boon companion, a cheery reveller, and withal a man of high temper, who would not take an insult even from the all-powerful boss himself. But in addition to this, he impressed his comrades with the idea that among them all there was not one whose brain was so ready to devise a bloodthirsty scheme, or whose hand would be more capable of carrying it out. "He'll be the boy for the clean job," said the oldsters to one another, and waited their time until they could set him to his work. McGinty had instruments enough already, but he recognized that this was a supremely able one. He felt like a man holding a fierce bloodhound in leash. There were curs to do the smaller work, but some day he would slip this creature upon its prey. A few members of the lodge, Ted Baldwin among them, resented the rapid rise of the stranger and hated him for it. But they kept clear of him, for he was as ready to fight as to laugh. But if he gained favour with his fellows, there was another quarter, one which had become even more vital to him, in which he lost it. Etty Shafter's father would have nothing more to do with him, nor would he allow him to enter the house. Etty herself was too deeply in love to give him up altogether, and yet her own good sense warned her of what would come from a marriage with a man who was regarded as a criminal. One morning, after a sleepless night, she determined to see him, possibly for the last time, and make one strong endeavour to draw him from those evil influences which were sucking him down. She went to his house, as he had often begged her to do, and made her way into the room which he used as his sitting room. He was seated at a table, with his back turned and a letter in front of him. A sudden spirit of girlish mischief came over her. She was still only 19. He had not heard her when she pushed open the door. Now she tiptoed forward and laid her hand lightly upon his bended shoulders. If she had expected to startle him, she certainly succeeded, but only in turn to be startled herself. With a tiger spring, he turned on her, and his right hand was feeling for her throat. At the same instant, with the other hand, he crumpled up the paper that lay before him. For an instant he stood glaring. Then astonishment and joy took the place of the ferocity which had convulsed his features, a ferocity which had sent her shrinking back in horror as from something which had never before intruded into her gentle life.
"It's you," said he, mopping his brow. "And to think that you should come to me, heart of my heart, and I should find nothing better to do than to want to strangle you. Come then, darling," and he held out his arms. "Let me make it up to you."
But she had not recovered from that sudden glimpse of guilty fear which she had read in the man's face. All her woman's instinct told her that it was not the mere fright of a man who is startled. Guilt, that was it. Guilt and fear.
"What's come over you, Jack?" she cried. "Why were you so scared of me? Oh, Jack, if your conscience was at ease, you would not have looked at me like that."
"Sure, I was thinking of other things, and when you came tripping so lightly on those fairy feet of yours—"
"No, no, it was more than that, Jack."
Then a sudden suspicion seized her.
"Let me see that letter you were writing."
"Ah, Etty, I couldn't do that." Her suspicions became certainties.
"It's to another woman," she cried. "I know it. Why else should you hold it from me? Was it to your wife that you were writing? How am I to know that you are not a married man? You, a stranger that nobody knows."
"I am not married, Etty. See now, I swear it. You're the only one woman on earth to me. By the cross of Christ, I swear it." He was so white with passionate earnestness that she could not but believe him.
"Well, then," she cried, "why will you not show me the letter?"
"I'll tell you, Akushla," said he. "I'm under oath not to show it, and just as I wouldn't break my word to you, so I would keep it to those who hold my promise. It's the business of the lodge, and even to you it's secret. And if I was scared when a hand fell on me, can't you understand it when it might have been the hand of a detective?" She felt that he was telling the truth. He gathered her into his arms and kissed away her fears and doubts. "Sit here by me, then. It's a queer throne for such a queen, but it's the best your poor lover can find. He'll do better for you some of these days, I'm thinking. Now, your mind is easy once again, is it not?"
"How can it ever be at ease, Jack, when I know that you are a criminal among criminals, when I never know the day that I may hear you are in court for murder? McMurdo the Scourer, that's what one of our boarders called you yesterday. It went through my heart like a knife."
"Sure, hard words break no bones."
"But they were true."
"Well, dear, it's not so bad as you think. We are but poor men that are trying in our own way to get our rights." Etty threw her arms round her lover's neck.
"Give it up, Jack, for my sake, for God's sake, give it up. It was to ask you that I came here today. Oh, Jack, see, I beg it of you on my bended knees. Kneeling here before you, I implore you to give it up."
He raised her and soothed her with her head against his breast. "Sure, my darling, you don't know what it is you're asking. How could I give it up when it would be to break my oath and to desert my comrades? If you could see how things stand with me, you could never ask it of me. Besides, if I wanted to, how could I do it? You don't suppose that the lodge would let a man go free with all its secrets?"
"I've thought of that, Jack. I've planned it all. Father has saved some money. He is weary of this place where the fear of these people darkens our lives. He is ready to go. We would fly together to Philadelphia or New York, where we would be safe from them."
McMurdo laughed. "The lodge has a long arm. Do you think it could not stretch from here to Philadelphia or New York?"
"Well, then, to the West, or to England, or to Germany, where Father came from, anywhere to get away from this valley of fear."
McMurdo thought of old Brother Morris. "Sure, it's the second time I have heard the valley so named," said he. "The shadow does indeed seem to lie heavy on some of you."
It darkens every moment of our lives. Do you suppose that Ted Baldwin has ever forgiven us? If it were not that he fears you, what do you suppose our chances would be? If you saw the look in those dark, hungry eyes of his when they fall on me.
By gar, I'd teach him better manners if I caught him at it.
But see here, little girl, I can't leave here. I can't. Take that from me once and for all. But if you will leave me to find my own way, I will try to prepare a way of getting honourably out of it.
There is no honour in such a matter.
Well, well, it's just how you look at it. But if you'll give me 6 months, I'll work it so that I can leave without being ashamed to look others in the face. The girl laughed with joy. 6 months? She cried. Is it a promise? Well, it may be 7 or 8, but within a year at the furthest, we will leave the valley behind us. It was the most that Etty could obtain, and yet it was something. There was this distant light to illuminate the gloom of the immediate future. She returned to her father's house more light-hearted than she had ever been since Jack McMurdo had come into her life. It might be thought that, as a member, all the doings of the society would be told to him, but he was soon to discover that the organization was wider and more complex than the simple lodge. Even Boss McGinty was ignorant as to many things, for there was an official named the County Delegate, living at Hobson's Patch, farther down the line, who had power over several different lodges, which he wielded in a sudden and arbitrary way. Only once did McMurdo see him, a sly, little, grey-haired rat of a man with a slinking gait and a sidelong glance which was charged with malice. Evans Pott was his name, and even the great boss of Vermissa felt towards him something of the repulsion and fear which the huge Danton may have felt for the puny but dangerous Robespierre. One day Scanlon, who was McMurdo's fellow boarder, received a note from McGinty enclosing one from Evans Pott, which informed him that he was sending over 2 good men, Lawler and Andrews, who had instructions to act in the neighbourhood, though it was best for the cause that no particulars as to their objects should be given. Would the bodymaster see to it that suitable arrangements be made for their lodgings and comfort until the time for action should arrive? McGinty added that it was impossible for anyone to remain secret at the Union House, and that therefore he would be obliged if McMurdo and Scanlon would put the strangers up for a few days in their boarding house. The same evening the 2 men arrived, each carrying his gripsack. Lawler was an elderly man, shrewd, silent, and self-contained, clad in an old black frock coat, which, with his soft felt hat and ragged, grizzled beard, gave him a general resemblance to an itinerant preacher. His companion, Andrews, was little more than a boy, frank-faced and cheerful, with the breezy manner of one who is out for a holiday and means to enjoy every minute of it. Both men were total abstainers and behaved in all ways as exemplary members of the society, with the one simple exception that they were assassins, who had often proved themselves to be the most capable instruments for this association of murder. Lawler had already carried out 14 commissions of the kind, and Andrews 3. They were, as McMurdo found, quite ready to converse about their deeds in the past, which they recounted with the half-bashful pride of men who had done good and unselfish service for the community. They were reticent, however, as to the immediate job in hand.
"They chose us because neither I nor the boy here drink," Lawler explained. "They can count on us saying no more than we should. You must not take it amiss, but it is the orders of the county delegate that we obey."
"Sure, we're all in it together," said Scanlon, McMurdo's mate, as the 4 sat together at supper.
That's true enough, and we'll talk till the cows come home of the killing of Charlie Williams or of Simon Bird or any other job in the past. But till the work is done, we say nothing.
There are half a dozen about here that I have a word to say to, said McMurdo with an oath. I suppose it isn't Jack Knox of Iron Hill that you're after. I'd go some way to see him get his deserts.
No, it's not him yet.
Or Herman Strauss?
No, nor him either.
Well, if you won't tell us, we can't make you, but I'd be glad to know.
Lawler smiled and shook his head. He was not to be drawn. In spite of the reticence of their guests, Scanlan and McMurdo were quite determined to be present at what they called the fun. When, therefore, at an early hour one morning, McMurdo heard them creeping down the stairs, he awakened Scanlan, and the two hurried on their clothes. When they were dressed, they found that the others had stolen out, leaving the door open behind them. It was not yet dawn, and by the light of the lamps they could see the two men some distance down the street. They followed them warily, treading noiselessly in the deep snow. The boarding-house was near the edge of the town, and soon they were at the crossroads which is beyond its boundary. Here three men were waiting, with whom Lawler and Andrews held a short, eager conversation. Then they all moved on together. It was clearly some notable job which needed numbers. At this point, there are several trails which lead to various mines. The strangers took that which led to the Crow Hill, a huge business which was in strong hands, which had been able, thanks to their energetic and fearless New England manager, Josiah H. Dunn, to keep some order and discipline during the long reign of terror. Day was breaking now, and a line of workmen were slowly making their way, singly and in groups, along the blackened path. McMurdo and Scanlan strolled on with the others, keeping in sight of the men whom they followed. A thick mist lay over them, and from the heart of it there came the sudden scream of a steam whistle. It was the 10-minute signal before the cages descended and the day's labour began. When they reached the open space round the mine shaft, there were 100 miners waiting, stamping their feet and blowing on their fingers, for it was bitterly cold. The strangers stood in a little group under the shadow of the engine house. Scanlan and McMurdo climbed a heap of slag, from which the whole scene lay before them. They saw the mine engineer, a great bearded Scotchman named Menzies, come out of the engine house and blow his whistle for the cages to be lowered. At the same instant, a tall, loose-framed young man with a clean-shaved, earnest face advanced eagerly towards the pithead. As he came forward, his eyes fell upon the group, silent and motionless, under the engine house. The men had drawn down their hats and turned up their collars to screen their faces. For a moment, the presentiment of death laid its cold hand upon the manager's heart. At the next, he had shaken it off and saw only his duty towards intrusive strangers.
"Who are you?" he asked as he advanced. "What are you loitering there for?"
There was no answer, but the lad Andrews stepped forward and shot him in the stomach. The 100 waiting miners stood as motionless and helpless as if they were paralyzed. The manager clapped his two hands to the wound and doubled himself up. Then he staggered away, but another of the assassins fired, and he went down sidewise, kicking and clawing among a heap of clinkers. Menzies, the Scotchman, gave a roar of rage at the sight and rushed with an iron spanner at the murderers, but was met by two balls in the face which dropped him dead at their very feet. There was a surge forward of some of the miners, and an articulate cry of pity and of anger, but a couple of the strangers emptied their six-shooters over the heads of the crowd, and they broke and scattered, some of them rushing wildly back to their homes in Vermissa. When a few of the bravest had rallied, and there was a return to the mine, The murderous gang had vanished in the mists of morning without a single witness being able to swear to the identity of these men who, in front of 100 spectators, had wrought this double crime. Scanlan and McMurdo made their way back. Scanlan somewhat subdued, for it was the first murder job that he had seen with his own eyes, and it appeared less funny than he had been led to believe. The horrible screams of the dead manager's wife pursued them as they hurried to the town. McMurdo was absorbed and silent, but he showed no sympathy for the weakening of his companion.
"Sure, it's like a war," he repeated. "What is it but a war between us and them, and we hit back where we best can?"
There was high revel in the lodge room of the Union House that night, not only over the killing of the manager and engineer of the Crow Hill mine, which would bring this organization into line with the other blackmailed and terror-stricken companies of the district, but also over a distant triumph which had been wrought by the hands of the lodge itself. It would appear that when the county delegate had sent over 5 good men to strike a blow in Vermissa, he had demanded that in return 3 Vermissa men should be secretly selected and sent across to kill William Hales of Stake Royal, one of the best-known and most popular mine owners in the Gilmerton district, a man who was believed not to have an enemy in the world, for he was in all ways a model employer. He had insisted, however, upon efficiency in the work, and had therefore paid off certain drunken and idle employees who were members of the all-powerful society. Coffin notices hung outside his door had not weakened his resolution, and so, in a free, civilized country, he found himself condemned to death. The execution had now been duly carried out. Ted Baldwin, who sprawled now in the seat of honour beside the bodymaster, had been chief of the party. His flushed face and glazed, bloodshot eyes told of sleeplessness and drink. He and his 2 comrades had spent the night before among the mountains. They were unkempt and weather-stained. But no heroes, returning from a forlorn hope, could have had a warmer welcome from their comrades. The story was told and retold amid cries of delight and shouts of laughter. They had waited for their man as he drove home at nightfall, taking their station at the top of a steep hill where his horse must be at a walk. He was so furred to keep out the cold that he could not lay his hand on his pistol. They had pulled him out and shot him again and again. He had screamed for mercy. The screams were repeated for the amusement of the lodge.
"Let's hear again how he squealed," they cried.
None of them knew the man, but there is eternal drama in a killing, and they had shown the scourers of Gilmerton that the Vermissa men were to be relied upon. There had been one contretemps, for a man and his wife had driven up while they were still emptying their revolvers into the silent body. It had been suggested that they should shoot them both, but they were harmless folk who were not connected with the mines, so they were sternly bidden to drive on and keep silent, lest a worse thing befall them. And so the blood-mottled figure had been left as a warning to all such hard-hearted employers, and the 3 noble avengers had hurried off into the mountains where unbroken nature comes down to the very edge of the furnaces and the slag heaps. Here they were, safe and sound, their work well done, and the plaudits of their companions in their ears. It had been a great day for the Scourers. The shadow had fallen even darker over the valley. But as the wise general chooses the moment of victory in which to redouble his efforts so that his foes may have no time to steady themselves after disaster, so Boss McGinty, looking out upon the scene of his operations with his brooding and malicious eyes, had devised a new attack upon those who opposed him. That very night, as the half-drunken company broke up, he touched McMurdo on the arm and led him aside into that inner room where they had had their first interview.
"See here, my lad," said he, "I've got a job that's worthy of you at last. You'll have the doing of it in your own hands."
"Proud I am to hear it," McMurdo answered.
"You can take two men with you, Manders and Riley. They have been warned for service. We'll never be right in this district until Chester Wilcox has been settled, and you'll have the thanks of every lodge in the coalfields if you can down him."
"I'll do my best, anyhow. Who is he, and where shall I find him?" McGinty took his eternal, half-chewed, half-smoked cigar from the corner of his mouth and proceeded to draw a rough diagram on a page torn from his notebook. "He's the chief foreman of the Iron Dyke Company. He's a hard citizen, an old color sergeant of the war, all scars and grizzle. We've had two tries at him, but had no luck, and Jim Carnaway lost his life over it. Now it's for you to take it over. That's the house, all alone at the Iron Dyke Crossroad, same as you see here on the map, without another within earshot. It's no good by day. He's armed, shoots quick and straight, with no questions asked. But at night, well, there he is with his wife, three children, and a hired help. You can't pick or choose. It's all or none. If you could get a bag of blasting powder at the front door with a slow match to it..."
"What's the man done?"
"Didn't I tell you he shot Jim Carnaway?"
"Why did he shoot him?"
"What in thunder has that to do with you? Carnaway was about his house at night, and he shot him. That's enough for me and you. You've got to settle the thing right."
"There's these two women and the children. Do they go up, too?"
"They have to. Else how can we get him?"
"It seems hard on them, for they've done nothing."
"What sort of fool's talk is this? Do you back out?"
"Easy, Counselor, easy. What have I ever said or done that you should think I would be after standing back from an order of the bodymaster of my own lodge? If it's right or if it's wrong, it's for you to decide."
"You'll do it, then?"
"Of course I will do it."
"When?"
"Well, you had best give me a night or two, that I may see the house and make my plans. Then..."
"Very good," said McGinty, shaking him by the hand. "I leave it with you. It will be a great day when you bring us the news. It's just the last stroke that will bring them all to their knees."
McMurdo thought long and deeply over the commission which had been so suddenly placed in his hands. The isolated house in which Chester Wilcox lived was about 5 miles off in an adjacent valley. That very night he started off all alone to prepare for the attempt. It was daylight before he returned from his reconnaissance. Next day he interviewed his two subordinates, Manders and Riley, reckless youngsters who were as elated as if it were a deer hunt. 2 nights later, they met outside the town, all three armed, and one of them carrying a sack stuffed with the powder which was used in the quarries. It was 2 in the morning before they came to the lonely house. The night was a windy one, with broken clouds drifting swiftly across the face of a three-quarter moon. They had been warned to be on their guard against bloodhounds, so they moved forward cautiously, with their pistols cocked in their hands. But there was no sound, save the howling of the wind, and no movement but the swaying branches above them. McMurdo listened at the door of the lonely house, but all was still within. Then he leaned the powder bag against it, ripped a hole in it with his knife, and attached the fuse. When it was well alight, he and his two companions took to their heels and were some distance off, safe and snug in a sheltering ditch, before the shattering roar of the explosion, with the low, deep rumble of the collapsing building, told them that their work was done. No cleaner job had ever been carried out in the blood-stained annals of the society. But alas! That work so well organized and boldly carried out should all have gone for nothing. Warned by the fate of the various victims, and knowing that he was marked down for destruction, Chester Wilcox had moved himself and his family only the day before to some safer and less known quarters where a guard of police should watch over them. It was an empty house which had been torn down by the gunpowder, and the grim old colour sergeant of the war was still teaching discipline to the miners of Iron Dyke. "Leave him to me," said McMurdo. "He's my man, and I'll get him sure if I have to wait a year for him." A vote of thanks and confidence was passed in full lodge, and so for the time the matter ended. When, a few weeks later, it was reported in the papers that Wilcox had been shot at from an ambuscade, it was an open secret that McMurdo was still at work upon his unfinished job. Such were the methods of the Society of Freemen, and such were the deeds of the Scourers by which they spread their rule of fear over the great and rich district which was for so long a period haunted by their terrible presence. Why should these pages be stained by further crimes? Have I not said enough to show the men and their methods? These deeds are written in history, and there are records wherein one may read the details of them. There one may learn of the shooting of policemen Hunt and Evans because they had ventured to arrest two members of the society, a double outrage planned at the Vermissa Lodge and carried out in cold blood upon two helpless and disarmed men. There also one may read of the shooting of Mrs. Larby when she was nursing her husband, who had been beaten almost to death by orders of Boss McGinty, the killing of the elder Jenkins, shortly followed by that of his brother, the mutilation of James Murdoch, the blowing up of the Staphouse family, and the murder of the Stendals, all followed hard upon one another in the same terrible winter. Darkly the shadow lay upon the valley of fear. The spring had come, with running brooks and blossoming trees. There was hope for all nature, bound so long in an iron grip. But nowhere was there any hope for the men and women who lived under the yoke of the terror. Never had the cloud above them been so dark and hopeless as in the early summer of the year 1875. Chapter 6. Danger. It was the height of the Reign of Terror. McMurdo, who had already been appointed inner deacon, with every prospect of some day succeeding McGinty as bodymaster, was now so necessary to the counsels of his comrades that nothing was done without his help and advice. The more popular he became, however, with the freemen, the blacker were the scowls which greeted him as he passed along the streets of Vermissa. In spite of their terror, the citizens were taking heart to band themselves together against their oppressors. Rumours had reached the lodge of secret gatherings in the Herald office and of distribution of firearms among the law-abiding people. But McGinty and his men were undisturbed by such reports. They were numerous, resolute, and well-armed. Their opponents were scattered and powerless. It would all end, as it had done in the past, in aimless talk and possibly in impotent arrests. So said McGinty, McMurdo, and all the bolder spirits. It was a Saturday evening in May. Saturday was always the lodge night, and McMurdo was leaving his house to attend it when Morris, the weaker brother of the order, came to see him. His brow was creased with care, and his kindly face was drawn and haggard. "Can I speak with you freely, Mr. McMurdo?"
"Sure."
"I can't forget that I spoke my heart to you once, and that you kept it to yourself, even though the boss himself came to ask you about it."
"What else could I do if you trusted me? It wasn't that I agreed with what you said."
I know that well. But you are the one that I can speak to and be safe. I've a secret here.
He put his hand to his breast,
and it is just burning the life out of me. I wish it had come to any one of you but me. If I tell it, it will mean murder for sure. If I don't, it may bring the end of us all. God help me, but I am near out of my wits over it.
McMurdo looked at the man earnestly. He was trembling in every limb. He poured some whiskey into a glass and handed it to him.
That's the physic for the likes of you, said he. Now, let me hear of it.
Morris drank, and his white face took a tinge of colour.
I can tell it to you all in one sentence, said he. There is a detective on our trail.
McMurdo stared at him in astonishment.
Why, man, you're crazy, he said. Isn't the place full of police and detectives, and what harm did they ever do us?
No, no, it's no man of the district. As you say, we know them, and it is little that they can do. But you've heard of Pinkertons?
I've read of some folk of that name.
Well, you can take it from me. You've no show when they're on your trail. It's not a take-it-or-miss-it government concern. It's a dead earnest business proposition that's out for results and keeps out till by hook or crook it gets them. If a Pinkerton man is deep in this business, we are all destroyed.
We must kill him.
Ah, it's the first thought that came to you. So it will be up at the lodge. Didn't I say to you that it would end in murder?
Sure, what is murder? Isn't it common enough in these parts?
It is indeed, but it's not for me to point out the man that is to be murdered. I'd never rest easy again. And yet it's our own necks that may be at stake. In God's name, what shall I do?
He rocked to and fro in his agony of indecision.
But his words had moved McMurdo deeply. It was easy to see that he shared the other's opinion as to the danger and the need for meeting it. He gripped Morris's shoulder and shook him in his earnestness.
"See here, man!" he cried, and he almost screeched the words in his excitement. "You won't gain anything by sitting keening like an old wife at a wake. Let's have the facts. Who is the fellow? Where is he? How did you hear of him? Why did you come to me?"
"I came to you, for you are the one man that would advise me. I told you that I had a store in the East before I came here. I left good friends behind me, and one of them is in the telegraph service. Here's a letter that I had from him yesterday. It's this part from the top of the page. You can read it yourself."
This was what McMurdo read.
"How are the scourers getting on in your parts? We read plenty of them in the papers. Between you and me, I expect to hear news from you before long. 5 big corporations and the 2 railroads have taken the thing up in dead earnest. They mean it, and you can bet they'll get there. They are right deep down into it. Pinkerton has taken hold under their orders, and his best man, Birdie Edwards, is operating. The thing has got to be stopped right now.
Now read the postscript.
Of course, what I give you is what I learned in business, so it goes no further. It's a queer cipher that you handle by the yard every day and can get no meaning from."
McMurdo sat in silence for some time, with the letter in his listless hands. The mist had lifted for a moment, and there was the abyss before him.
"Does anyone else know of this?" he asked.
"I have told no one else."
"But this man, your friend, has he any other person that he would be likely to write to?"
"Well, I dare say he knows one or two more."
"Of the lodge?
It's likely enough."
"I was asking because it is likely that he may have given some description of this fellow, Birdie Edwards. Then we could get on his trail."
"Well, it's possible, but I should not think he knew him. He's just telling me the news that came to him by way of business. How would he know this Pinkerton man?"
McMurdo gave a violent start.
"By gar!" he cried. "I've got him. What a fool I was not to know it. Lord, but we're in luck. We will fix him before he can do any harm. See here, Morris, will you leave this thing in my hands?" Sure, if you will only take it off mine.
I'll do that. You can stand right back and let me run it. Even your name need not be mentioned. I'll take it all on myself, as if it were to me that this letter has come. Will that content you?
It's just what I would ask.
Then leave it at that and keep your head shut. Now, I'll get down to the lodge, and we'll soon make old man Pinkerton sorry for himself.
You wouldn't kill this man.
The less you know, friend Morris, the easier your conscience will be, and the better you will sleep. Ask no questions and let these things settle themselves. I have hold of it now.
Morris shook his head sadly as he left.
I feel that his blood is on my hands, he groaned.
Self-protection is no murder anyhow, said McMurdo, smiling grimly. It's him or us. I guess this man would destroy us all if we left him long in the valley.
Why, Brother Morris, we'll have to elect you bodymaster yet, for you've surely saved the lodge.
And yet it was clear from his actions that he thought more seriously of this new intrusion than his words would show. It may have been his guilty conscience. It may have been the reputation of the Pinkerton organization. It may have been the knowledge that great rich corporations had set themselves the task of clearing out the Scourers. But whatever his reason, his actions were those of a man who is preparing for the worst. Every paper which would incriminate him was destroyed before he left the house. After that, he gave a long sigh of satisfaction, for it seemed to him that he was safe. And yet the danger must still have pressed somewhat upon him, for on his way to the lodge he stopped at old man Shafter's. The house was forbidden him, but when he tapped at the window, Etty came out to him. The dancing Irish deviltry had gone from her lover's eyes. She read his danger in his earnest face.
"Something has happened," she cried. "Oh, Jack, you are in danger!"
"Sure, it's not very bad, my sweetheart, and yet it might be wise that we make a move before it is worse."
"Make a move?"
"I promised you once that I would go some day. I think the time is coming. I had news tonight, bad news, and I see trouble coming."
"The police?"
"Well, a Pinkerton. But sure you wouldn't know what that is, a Cushla, nor what it may mean to the likes of me. I'm too deep in this thing, and I may have to get out of it quick. You said you would come with me if I went."
"Oh, Jack, it would be the saving of you."
"I'm an honest man in some things, Etty. I wouldn't hurt a hair of your bonny head for all that the world can give, nor ever pull you down one inch from the golden throne above the clouds where I always see you. Would you trust me?" She put her hand in his without a word. "Well, then, listen to what I say, and do as I order you, for indeed it's the only way for us. Things are going to happen in this valley. I feel it in my bones. There may be many of us that will have to look out for ourselves. I'm one, anyhow. If I go, by day or night, it's you that must come with me."
"I'd come after you, Jack."
"No, no, you shall come with me. If this valley is closed to me, and I can never come back, how can I leave you behind, and me perhaps in hiding from the police, with never a chance of a message? It's with me you must come. I know a good woman in the place I come from, and it's there I'd leave you till we can get married. Will you come?"
"Yes, Jack, I will come."
"God bless you for your trust in me. It's a fiend out of hell that I should be if I abused it. Now, mark you, Etty, it will be just a word to you, and when it breaches you, you will drop everything and come right down to the waiting room at the depot and stay there till I come for you. Day or night, I'll come at the word, Jack." Somewhat eased in mind, now that his own preparations for escape